Writing as spiritual process.
A lot of us write, we find out what we think as we're writing, as the ideas flow, as things that maybe you would consider in a conversation, but because you're sitting down and are trying to make all these connections, so there's a kind of internal mining that is sometimes definitely intellectual, but also sometimes can feel very spiritual, like connecting with voices in the past, voices that have influenced you, whether they are, you know, other writers you've read or people in your family who told stories.
That's Edwige Dantica. We speak with her about her acclaimed new collection of essays, We're Alone. It's an intimate exploration of the influences that have shaped her life, the stories of her ancestors, the torments and resilience of her native country, Haiti, and the experience of immigration. Then we play a portion of our 2010 interview with Tracy Kidder about his book, Mountains Beyond Mountains. It's about the late great doctor and humanitarian Paul Farmer and his work in Haiti. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Celebrated Haitian-American writer Edwige Dantica has written works of fiction, short story, memoir, and travel narrative. They include her memoir, Brother, I'm Dying, which was a 2007 finalist for the National Book Award and a 2008 winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award. Now she's come out with We're Alone, tracing a loose arc from Dantica's childhood to the COVID-19 pandemic and recent events in Haiti. The essays gathered in We're Alone include personal narrative, reportage, and tributes to mentors and heroes that explore several abiding themes: environmental catastrophe, the traumas of colonialism, motherhood, and the complexities of resilience. We spoke with Dantica in August. Here's our conversation. Edwige Dantica, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so thrilled to have you here because you are such a wonderful writer, and I have been wanting to do this actually for years. So this is a wonderful book, a wonderful collection of essays, We're Alone. I wanted to ask you about the title of this collection, We're Alone, because on the last page, you say, we're actually not alone. So why that title?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. We're Alone, I think the title sort of reflects in the way that you and I are alone right now. You know, We're Alone usually suggests a common saying these days, you know, no one's coming to save us. But in this context, I'm thinking about the way that readers and writers are alone together. Because when I was growing up, there were some extraordinary storytellers in my family who gathered people together. And I love that. That really is the foundation of my writing and storytelling. But there's nothing that felt more intimate to me than sitting in a corner with a book. And I felt like I was alone with the author. So it's like we're alone together. It's being alone together. And of course, I'm drawing from a poem by a Haitian writer, Roulon Chassagne, who also raises this aspect of being alone with nature, of the just different ways that we can have an intimacy with writers and readers and the written word in general.
And this is a very intimate collection, beautifully, beautifully written, very much a work of witness. And you talk about wanting to bear witness, that you say you want to be a witnessing writer. Tell us what you mean by that.
I remember first encountering that idea of a writer as witness, reading an interview in the 1980s that I think that James Baldwin did with Julius Lester. And Lester asks Baldwin, like, so what do you mean by saying that, you know, you're a witness? And of course, there's that element, you know, Baldwin grew up in the church, and there's that element in religion of being, you know, a witness. but this idea also of just recounting events of your time, certainly not all of them, but the ones that happen to touch you in a certain way and that you feel you must speak to and address the things that, you know, that are haunting you sometimes. So this element of also using writing as a way of recording both things that are outward and inward, which continues along with this aspect of being alone, of being alone with your thoughts, you know, when you're writing, while at the same time communicating with a larger group of people that may not even exist yet, you know, that may be like future readers, as were these writers who were reaching back in the past for me as a young woman who was reading voraciously to try to find that kind of witness.
And when you say outward and inward, let's just say more about that. I think I know what you mean, but expand on that.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, most of the writers I love, I feel like are exploring sort of the inner depths of themselves. You know, in essays, you know, Montaigne, the idea of essays came from the French essayer, you know, where even if you feel like you're reading something definitive, something final, it's still a quest. And that starts with, you know, some internal reflection, some internal digging. And a lot of us write, we find out what we think. We find out ways to pin down exactly what we think as we're writing, as the ideas flow, as things that maybe you would consider in a conversation, but because you're sitting down and are trying to make all these connections. So there's a kind of internal mining that is sometimes definitely intellectual, but also sometimes can feel very spiritual, like connecting with voices in the past, voices that have influenced you, whether they are, you know, other writers you've read or people in your family who told stories. So that's a kind of going over. And sometimes I feel like in this collection too, that I was revisiting material that I had gone through before, but I had written about maybe about my mother as a daughter, but now I'm also writing about my mother as a fellow mother who had to leave a young child when she was in her 30s. And I'm way past my 30s now. So like that interiority, just like as one gets older too. And then knowing, you know, even if to be freely and honestly writing, you have to kind of pretend no one is reading it, but knowing that at some point, some of this will be with someone else, will be read by someone else. You know, that's the outward part of it for me.
Yeah, and hence the witness. Now, you mentioned before and now again, the storytellers of your childhood, the kitchen poets, as you call them. And I love this. You said they carried stories like treasures inside of them. Tell us about some of those storytellers of your childhood. What were their stories about?
Well, one of the, you know, the first people who I felt so eloquently pin down that element of my childhood, and you know, and I read her when I was in high school, was Paul Marshall, and she's the person who coined this term kitchen poets. So for me, the kitchen poets of my childhood were my aunt. So I was, you know, I was born in Haiti, and 2 years after I was born, my dad moved to New York, and when I was four, my mom joined him, and I was raised by my aunt and uncle for 8 years until I joined my parents in Brooklyn when I was 12. So during that time, I was raised by my aunt. I was in the household of my aunt and uncle, but I also, you know, in the summertime, I was sent to the countryside to be with my uncle's wife, who's like my grandmother by marriage. And I would visit my maternal grandmother in another area of the country in Léogâne, but in the seaside place.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with the great writer Edwige Dantica about her new collection of essays, We're Alone. So now back to The Witness, because the essays in this collection paint such a vivid picture of the oppressiveness of colonialism, of the position that Haiti has, as well, actually, Haiti threw off the colonial yoke before anybody else did, but I think we can safely say is still under it in different ways. And it was so powerful to read. I want to start out where, when you were in Haiti visiting your in-laws, when an announcement was made that the price of gasoline and diesel was being raised so that Haiti could qualify for low-interest loans from the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. So first of all, just briefly explain that, and then I'll ask you about, you know, what you went through when that announcement was made.
Well, it was the summer of 2018. You know, the family and I would go to Haiti regularly, and it was there was the extra excitement in Haiti at that time of the World Cup, where, you know, like a lot of Caribbean countries very into soccer. So my family and I were at the opening of this library that this wonderful organization, Haiti Projects, has and continues to have. And then afterwards, we went to visit my mother-in-law, who maintains a home in Haiti, who is going back and forth, but is involved in a community in the South. And so, and when that announcement was made that the price of fuel was going to rise after Brazil lost, and Brazil was sort of the favorite team of Haitian soccer lovers, and suddenly really a kind of movement started at that point. I mean, a lot of people see it as that summer was the kickoff of the Coup Compito Caribe, which was also in a movement that was asking for accountability about how the funds were being spent with a fuel deal that was made with Venezuela. And so there were a lot of government and anti-corruption protest followed for several months after that. But the beginning of that movement started with that day. And we were living mostly in Miami at that time. We just happened to be in the country that day to see to experience the start of that.
So when that happened, riots broke out, and you were stopped by a man. I mean, there were also people who were going out and kind of marauding, you know, I mean, stopping people and robbing people. And you were stopped by a man who said, you know, very poignantly to you, he said, "We want a future, but they keep snatching it away."
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't so, we were in the countryside, so it wasn't so much marauding as people who were, so they were roadblocks, and they were roadblocks at different moments. And it was a way of protesting. And in the countryside, things tend to be milder. You know, we weren't in Port-au-Prince. And so folks were, even in the protests, you know, were neighborly in a way. So you had these conversations, and we would be like, we would say, "Hey, you know, it's dark, we want to get home." And we had a sort of conversation with the young people. It wasn't the stuff you see now in the news a lot with the cities. I mean, you could talk to people, you could kind of reason for passage. And at the same time, you could understand the frustration of people who suddenly, a lot of the young men who work, you know, they're drivers, they do motor taxis. And so the price of fuel was suddenly going to complicate their lives. So people would explain the reason of the protest. And I think that's partly was also because we were in a smaller area. And these are people who could be, you know, who were people we recognized, because I grew up with an uncle who lived in what people would call now, you know, in Bel Air, that he would live 50 years in a poor neighborhood in Haiti. So these were people we knew, like we had a conversation. So we would say, you know, "Come on, help us out, let us through." And then these young men would say, "You know, we'd love to, but this is why we're protesting." And this was still early in the point where you could kind of and then the setting that we're have this kind of conversations, because we were with two young kids in the car. We were with some friends who lived there. So and also I'm, you know, with my own kind of curiosity, I was like, I wanted to know, and we would have these conversations that didn't get tense to the point that people are seeing today.
And it's in that same essay that you actually have one paragraph that goes through a condensed but devastating history of Haiti and its oppression. And I'm just going to mention some of the highlights from the genocide of the original inhabitants by Christopher Columbus, to slavery, to after liberation, the debt to France, $30 billion worth by this point. I'm not even sure if it's paid off. The Duvalier dictatorship, the overthrowing of the democratically elected Jean-Bertrand Aristide, which was aided and abetted by the USA, a massive earthquake, hurricanes, another earthquake, a cholera epidemic. I mean, this is just so heartrending. And one really then understands something about immigration, which is something you really go into the book a lot. But I guess I want to ask first, how do you bear all this when one witnesses this about one's own country, the incredible injustice that just never seems to end? How do you cope with that?
Well, I mean, I don't see it so much as an issue of coping, because obviously I have distance. It's a privilege in a way. And when I, in that moment in the essay, I was thinking often of even like being asked that you ask it in a much more generous way than a lot of people who are like, what's wrong with, like, why can't Haiti catch a break? And then we kind of, Haitians, like just me, will have to say, well, this is what preceded what's happening now, or this is the background for this, because a lot of people don't know it, right? A lot of people don't know these things. But there's so many moments where, you know, even to younger people in my family, you know, where I have to say, so this is the background. And so that there was that moment where I was like, oh, this is why this is happening. And, you know, the debt that you mentioned, where Haiti post-independence had to pay for, you know, nearly a century, this debt to France, and then had to borrow from France to pay, like it was a double debt. The New York Times did a very lengthy series of articles about it. I think that was very helpful for people who were not aware of it before. But just all these reasons, it's kind of like having those conversations with the young men at that time, at those roadblocks, that if you don't ask, you don't quite understand the reasons for it. And I think of the essays, I think part of the intimacies that I sometimes feel like they're not just for outsiders, they're also for the young people in my family who have not been to Haiti, or, you know, as the generations go on, might be more and more removed than I am, to sort of know, like, if when they hear about Haiti, that it's sort of more complicated than what you see on the news every day. And a lot of this is the backstory for what we're going through.
Yeah, and you write about drafting a My Dungeon Shook letter to your daughters, which is part of telling them, I guess, this story, but also warning them about, you know, I mean, the conditions in this country. As you point out in this book, Edwige Dantica, in We're Alone, you point out that if Black people were going to another country and describing what they experience in this country, they would be asylum seekers under U.S. law. So tell us about that whole My Dungeon Shook letter, what the reference is, and how you do pass on both the history and the warning.
Actually, that, you know, I have to credit everyone who is evoked here, because it's kind of, you know, as I mentioned in the preface, the collection is a kind of rassemblage, this notion by the anthropologist, Haitian anthropologist and artist Gina Ulysse. It's a rassemblage in the way that idea of the asylum seeking is from an immigration attorney who wrote in the Washington Post about that. So that's not my unique idea. But yes, a friend of mine recently pointed it out to me that the book is my Dungeon Shook letter, like the whole thing. And I hadn't thought of it that way until my friend Renee pointed that out. And for those who may not be familiar, in The Fire Next Time, James Baldwin writes to his nephew James a letter, dear James, in which he sort of talks about all the different realities. So I think for immigrant parents, immigrant families, and, you know, especially as these generations merge from immigrant to, you know, first to second to all these generations where you have the younger generation becoming more and more American, in a way, my Dungeon Shook letters have different layers, right? Because as the immigrants, I knew that in every immigrant household, you know, the fight in a way is to not forget, right? Like my parents, so much of their lives was spent telling and showing us that, yes, you cannot forget Haiti. Whatever happens in your life, you cannot forget Haiti. And which led to our going back, which led to my wanting my children to go back, to taking them back with me. So there's that. And then there's also preparing them, you know, for the reality of life as young Black women in, you know, in America. So there's like, there's sort of two tiers to this kind of letter for immigrant parents, you know, immigrant families. And part of that includes the digging into the past, this telling of this history of also why we had to leave, why we were here.
Why you had to leave and then come here and often find conditions where the United States often seems hardly the refuge from violence that people fled Haiti for. I mean, you talk, for example, about how immigrants have been treated. Just maybe one example is when Aristide was overthrown, there was an influx of Haitians who were taken by the U.S. government and put into Guantanamo, where food was used as a kind of instrument of torture. There was a hunger strike by someone, you speak of her, a human rights activist, I think, Yolande Jean.
Yolande Jean, mm-hmm.
Say a little bit about what happened.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I think is sometimes not stated as much in the immigrant experience, right? Like of sort of, yes, people come for opportunities and yes, you know, there are things that happened in our lives that perhaps if our parents had not made these journeys would not have. But there are also sometimes such extraordinary sacrifices made, right, for these opportunities. And, you know, I spend a lot of time with immigration lawyers, both for personal reasons and also in terms of groups that I've had affiliations with. And often a lot of them will talk about the fact that a lot of what we see in terms of how immigration detention is built was first tried in the recent era on Haitian immigrants. So when in the 1990s, early 1990s, after the coup against President Aristide in Haiti, a lot of people were coming by boat to Florida. And recently in Florida, the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the first people who came by boat to Florida and were housed in churches, and some of them were detained, but they were received in African-American churches, some of them in Florida. So that was about 50 years ago. But many of them were detained on Guantanamo. That was before Guantanamo was what we know of Guantanamo now. And people were detained behind, you know, barbed wires and the whole Guantanamo mechanism. And HIV positive people were not allowed to, you know, were detained there. And Yolande Jean was an activist who started a hunger strike. And actually a letter she wrote to her children were read by the actress Suzanne Sarandon as a protest. And eventually she was released. And there were also people detained at the Brooklyn Navy Yard in New York, where Rudy Giuliani was, I think, the attorney general at that time and went to Haiti to say, And when he came back, he said, "Oh, I spoke to the Duvalier. I spoke to the dictator, basically. And these people have no reason to be here." So immigration, of course, you know, it's very hot and hotly debated topic right now. But that story is often told in this one way, either as like hyper success, oh, we have all these invaders. But it's something in between in which people must never forget, because that's how we see it. Like, that's how I see it manifested in the people that I know and love and see all the time. There's so, you know, so much is sacrificed, but at the core of it are people who are looking often for a better future for their children. But they go through so much often that we don't hear as much about. I mean, now with the media, we see people going to the Darien Gap. We see all the, you know, we see more of the, there's more of that storytelling. But for every gain, there's so much sacrifice by the generation and everybody. It's like my parents who are like hoping for a better future for their children.
Yeah, but it's more than that. As you point out, I mean, climate change is going to create, I think, the fifth largest country in the world, that country being of people on the move, people who mm-hmm. are not just looking for a better life, but who are looking for food and water.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that we're starting to see that. And that's the thing where people talk about the root causes of immigration, right? Like people, yes, between climate change and wars and all the things that are displacing people, we're going to really have to think about, like, more and more people are going to be in these desperate situations where they will show up at these borders and then bigger walls get built, or like how, it's a very basic question, I think, that humanity has always faced, but that we're going to be facing in such a large way. It's like, how do we welcome a stranger who we consider a stranger? And who is a stranger? Who is a foreigner? And what does that mean when someone shows up with their baby at our door? And then we say, no, you're invading us. And what is that going to mean in the future? And more, when the people come in larger and larger numbers, I think that's going to be one of the most pressing, like, urgent questions of our time.
Yes, indeed. And many of those people will also be internal migrants.
Mm-hmm. And they're already, a lot of them, like in Haiti right now, are internally displaced within the country. Something like, we've heard, like 500,000 people because they've been pushed out of their homes. So yes, absolutely.
Edwige Dantika, stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. We're talking with the Haitian-American writer Edwige Dantika about her new book. It's a collection of essays titled We're Alone. I'd like to ask you a little bit about the situation in Haiti and how it got here. You have this really gripping chapter about the assassination of Jovenel Moïse. You know, there's so much propaganda. Was he a bad guy? Was he a good guy? What did you think of him? And what do you think about the current situation? I mean, he was assassinated, and now it seems like nobody's in charge.
Well, this too is a very complex situation. So he was chosen by his predecessor, who is the musician Michel Martelly, who's known, his musician name is Sweet Mickey. And he was just sanctioned by the United States for, they said, for drug trafficking, for supporting the armed groups. So he had been sanctioned before by Canada for it. So he was chosen to, in Haiti, you can't run two consecutive terms. And so apparently Jovenel Moïse was chosen by Martelly to kind of stand in the middle, and then he would return. And so I'm going by his record. And part of the protest that started in 2018 was also a protest against his presidency and the corruption. His I mean, his assassination was horrific in its brazenness, right? That he was assassinated in his home, and it's still not solved. Like, there are many, many people who have been said by a judge to be implicated, including the people closest to him. One of the people named was his former prime minister. His wife was also implicated in some way by this judge. She has denied involvement. They all have, and a lot of people have been implicated. And so in hindsight, it seems to have been something that was meant to destabilize the country to this point. There are a lot of very powerful people who have been supporting these armed groups, including according to these sanctions that the U.S. just named, including the former president, it seems. They have not made, you know, their evidence clear, but he was sanctioned recently. So I think the destabilization, the president's assassination is part of it. But what followed, then the armed groups who have been supported by business elites, by politicians, seem to have now just free rein. But at the core of it, and it's the weapons, because the armed groups would not have all the power they have. And sometimes they will film their stock of weapons and ammunition. And it's astounding.
So the weapons, where are they coming from?
Well, the weapons are primarily coming from the United States, often from South Florida. Many articles have been written about this. And actually, there were three people who were arrested, and they offer a kind of an example of how the weapons might get to Haiti. These people were going through different gun stores in Florida and buying them and putting them in barrels that also had food or clothing. I mean, the level of the weapons, especially when the leaders of these armed groups, like when they film themselves with the weapons, they don't seem like they're trickling in. They seem like they're coming in really in large numbers. But the way the weapons flow in so freely, either through Florida or some perhaps through the land border across from the Dominican Republic, just the way that flow is, it would be very hard to stop the violence without stopping the flow of weapons and ammunition, and also to find out how they're getting there, because sometimes these armed groups are very far inland, and so who is bringing them the weapons, or how are the weapons getting to them? And these weapons are causing so much disruption, certainly most in Haiti, but also in the Caribbean region and, you know, in general.
Right. And the people who have these weapons are very, very poor. So obviously somebody is subsidizing them or giving them the weapons. Somebody or people or groups that have real power. The weapons are coming from the United States, but I never really trust what the U.S. says about Haiti, because I just remember when the bigger earthquake happened, and Bill Clinton went down, and they were, you know, he was all about, we're going to rebuild Haiti. And, you know, what ended up happening was just another neocolonial project where factories were set up paying Haitians very poor wages, and nothing got rebuilt that was good for the Haitian people.
Yeah, I mean, it's often very, you know, the Build Back Betters, these projects are often other people's versions of visions of what they believe is right for Haitians, right? And when Haitians choose for themselves and it's inconvenient, it's like, yes, let's flip to, you know, the versions of the of rule that we want for you. And at that point, you know, post earthquake, it was decided that it was Michel Martelly who they sanctioned just recently. And maybe, you know, we never got to see the leaders Haitians might have chosen for themselves. I mean, but as we move towards next year, it might seem to people like going, you know, going back too deep into the past, right? The two that when we go to 2025, which will be the 200-year anniversary of the of this debt, you know, this ransom from France, it's a kind of, it shows you sort of how cyclical this crushing of Haiti is. And I think part of it, it's because of this history, you know, being the first Black Republic in this Western Hemisphere. And but I want people also to know, yes, there's all this that has been done to crush like the Haitian spirit. And that's one of the things that I also try to bring out in one of the chapters in the book. And I'm not, I don't want to sort of like, oh, this is like a resiliency narrative, because I don't think people should have to suffer endlessly to prove their resilience. But this idea, you know, and that's what I think a lot of, you know, I have still have a lot of family in Haiti. Some of them have had to be to move around quite a bit in the past 2 years to different areas when the armed groups come. But this idea of the Haitian imagination is stronger, the Haitian, like the visual imagination, the sort of the willingness to want to have and create and keep a nation is very strong. So that I also want people to know that sort of like what you're seeing all the time is also not all we are. And the fact that Haiti exists at all still is a testament to that, even though there's so much that's sort of piling up against Haiti right now.
Yeah, I think your collection in We're Alone really shows. I mean, I know resilience narratives can be kind of a, you know, cliche, but this is not a cliche. There is incredible strength and resilience in the Haitian people, an incredibly rich culture, an incredibly rich art and literature, all of which is alluded to and discussed in this wonderful collection. I just have one final question, which is, you say in the book that being human, and I think it's probably relevant to what we were just discussing, being human means having to keep beginning again. So as we go out, tell us what that means.
So I just remember, which goes back to the, you know, to the beginning of the book of being in the beginning of our conversation of being in Haiti for that visit in 2018 and just feeling so much joy and hope and being around young people, young writers, young readers. And one of the people who initiated the conversation wanted to know about the beginning of stories. And it made me think, and even talking about the beginning of stories, often people ask you how stories end. And in real life, we don't always know, right? We don't even know. We don't know how our lives will end. We don't know what the future holds. It's the cliche. But when talking about beginning, it made me think in this context of life too. I, you know, I'm at the sort of the even numbered age of 55, which somehow to me suggests a sense of renewal. I think being human is like sort of every day. And when I talk to my family members, especially those who are sometimes in very difficult situations in Port-au-Prince, they will say, you know, every day is a commitment. Every day you wake up, that's when you know. That's when you know you're alive. Every day is a kind of renewal. And that makes me think in sort of the easier context in which I live, how important and how powerful that is, that every day we begin again. And every day there's a sense of possibility in that. And writing, you know, the way that ties up to life and writing, it's sort of this idea of a blank page. And the beauty of being able to fill that is comparable sometimes to the, just the beauty of being able to start over, to start again. And that's what my parents did when they became immigrants here. And that's what we all do in so many different ways. And sometimes we're forced to do it. Sometimes we choose to do it. But certainly beginning again and embracing that to a certain extent and being grateful for that is beginning again.
And in therein lies the resilience, I think, that we spoke of. Edwige Dantica, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. It's really been a privilege to talk with you and a privilege to read this book. It is so wonderful.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me. And thank you for a really wonderful conversation.
Edwige Dantikat's We're Alone is out from Grey Wolf Press. It's been 2 years since the great doctor and humanitarian Paul Farmer died all too young at the age of 63. He dedicated his life to Partners in Health, the organization he founded in Haiti in 1983. In 2010, I spoke with author Tracy Kidder about his book about Paul Farmer and his work in Haiti, Mountains Beyond Mountains. I called Kidder up soon after the massive earthquake in Haiti to talk about the book and Paul Farmer's work. I started out by asking Kidder what Partners in Health was doing right then, in the wake of the earthquake.
Partners in Health has taken a leadership role in, I mean, for instance, they're the ones who've been coordinating and arranging, I think, the transportation of critically injured patients to the U.S. Navy ship Comfort. They did take the lead role in getting the central hospital back up and running, and they were asked by the World Health Organization to coordinate the surgical activities there. They've been managing or getting up and running 24 different operating rooms, which are now going 24 hours a day. And that's thanks to an enormous voluntary effort from a whole lot of the American medical establishment. I mean, I think it includes places like Dartmouth-Hitchcock, Partners Healthcare in Boston, which, of course, is that huge conglomeration of Mass General and the Brigham and the Beth Israel and Children's and so on, the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, Mount Sinai, University of Pennsylvania Medical School. In any case, they were probably the first responders. They're certainly some of the first responders, because Partners in Health, unlike far too many private aid organizations, particularly in Haiti, has striven for years, they've been there for 25 years, to make everything that they do there indigenous. They have 120 doctors, 600 nurses, 2,000 community health workers roughly, and almost all of them are Haitian. And they're all very well trained. So they were in a position to react very quickly. In addition, you know, they were the largest single health provider in rural Haiti with about 1.3 million patients. But all of their facilities, all their hospitals and clinics, their 12 hospitals and clinics that they run closely with the Ministry of Health, are all out in the countryside, and they were not damaged by the earthquake. So very quickly they were setting up field hospitals in Port-au-Prince, and very quickly they were transporting patients out to their hospitals and receiving them, at their hospitals, and just floods of patients. They've also flown some patients to the Dominican Republic and even to the United States. So it's been an enormous effort. But in addition, you know, they helped set up a surgery center in a town outside Port-au-Prince. It's, last I heard, staffed by University of Miami surgeons. So it's been an enormous effort, and I think they've done, you know, yeoman's work. That's what they usually do, combine idealism and competence in all the countries where they work.
And so often that's not what's rewarded with this kind of responsibility. Talk about why.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So talk about why Partners in Health, did get rewarded this time. Why were they uniquely positioned?
Well, because their hospitals weren't damaged, because they've been there for so long, and because it really is a Haitian operation, which is really unusual. I think that's the answer right there. And also, you know, they have extraordinary people at the top, like Paul Farmer and Ophelia Dahl. Paul Farmer, you know, in addition, is the deputy special envoy to Haiti, a UN job, and he should have an important role in designing the, you know, reconstruction of Haiti, which gives me a considerable hope. The big problem in Haiti, so far as private aid organizations are concerned, is that there are 10,000 of them, or more than 10,000 of them. And, you know, think about that. Think about the money that represents pouring into Haiti, and think about the results, which is, you know, I mean, Haiti's still one of the poorest countries in the world. So obviously something was wrong. And I think, speaking generally, I think what was wrong was not that all those 10,000 aid organizations were incompetent or weren't well-meaning, but that they weren't working together and they weren't working with the government and they weren't, you know, striving to make their projects indigenous. But not working with the government, I think, is one of the biggest issues. The excuse, the usual excuse that a government is weak or suffers from corruption, it just doesn't hold. I mean, if you fail to work with a government that suffers from corruption, then you simply play into the hands of the parasites who exist in every government everywhere. including governments of ours, you know. But Partners in Health has striven to make the appropriate agencies of the Haitian government, which is constitutionally elected, by the way, full partners in everything they do. One of the big problems with this earthquake is that, in large part because of the history of Haiti and our role in the history of Haiti, the government such as it is, there is very, very centralized in Port-au-Prince. And this earthquake absolutely decapitated the government. I mean, just destroyed it. Now, you know, it'll be some time before it can begin to get back on its feet. But the cultivation of better government, more effective government, more competent government, more honest government, that's crucial to the rebuilding of Haiti, it seems to me. And making projects coordinating the projects of private aid organizations and foreign government involvement, coordinating all of those is really important, and making sure that those projects are Haitianized. That is, you know, it's harder to do it that way. It's not easy to do it. But if you want to come in and start rebuilding, you ought to be hiring Haitians. And you should be training Haitians in the creation and repair of infrastructure. It just makes sense if you think about it.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think of Afghanistan, for example. There is, the example of, and now I'm blanking on his name, the author.
Mortensen.
Yes, Greg Mortensen, mm-hmm. where he found by enlisting the local population, mm-hmm. they could build things faster and better that were used by the population for mm-hmm. far less money.
Sure. Well, that's the other thing. I mean, Partners in Health, as I said, they have 1.3 million patients, and they do an extraordinary job. This is in what's called the Central Plateau and the Lower Artibonite. They have brought AIDS, tuberculosis, a host of other infectious diseases under control in the Central Plateau. And, you know, this was something that 10 years ago a lot of experts were saying just wasn't ever going to happen, wasn't possible. And they do this with remarkable economy. And the reason they can do it with remarkable economy is that their people are doing it are Haitian. And, you know, think of the effects of that. You now have these 100 and some we're really well-trained Haitian doctors, trained, I think, in the first instance by Paul Farmer and then by each other. You can make a virtuous cycle instead of a vicious one out of a... But if you just go in there and do it all in a sort of expatriate mode, in the end, your projects aren't going to last. You aren't going to create the sort of momentum that a country really needs in order to get out of the kind of mire that Haiti is in and has been in for a long time.
Yeah, and I wonder if you could also say, you know, I donated to Partners in Health, and I did so really feeling very secure.
Yeah.
In the sense that I felt that probably most of my most of what I donated was going to go to actual
that's
care.
Actually, that then you actually turn out to be right. Partners in Health spends 6% of donated money on administration, only 6%. That's a really low figure in the world of international aid, extremely low. So that means 94% of every dollar that's donated goes to direct services for, you know, the purchase of material, the salaries of doctors, you name it. That's the one great thing about Partners in Health. The thing that impressed me so much was that the money gets to the people the donors intended for. And that is not always the case, you know, and I think it's sort of horrifying. It's particularly not the case, has not been the case with a lot of USAID projects. We have these ridiculous policies where we tie our aid. Oxfam had a good article on this not so long ago. What I mean by tying our aid is that we insist that some of it go back to American pockets. So if, for instance, you're trying to do something in, I don't know, Afghanistan or wherever, and you have to fly there. If there are flights on an American-owned airline, you got to go on an American-owned airline, even if they're, you know, and that goes across, sort of across the board. And there are actually have been some USAID projects where fully half the money has gone back to, has never really left the Washington Beltway.
Or
I think that's obscene, frankly. And I think a lot of people... My sense is that a lot of people in the State Department and USAID agree and would like to
have it be different,
reform things. Yeah,
I read that Oxfam, or I read about the Oxfam article. I believe it's even worse than that in a way, because they were talking about how much agricultural aid in Haiti has actually
That's another issue. Yeah.
Has destroyed indigenous rice farming in Haiti.
Well, it's really a crock. That's a sham because I mean, after all, this is food that the U.S. government has bought in order to prop up farm prices here, basically subsidies to our own farmers. So in a way, what we do is we subsidize our farmers at the expense of the Haitian ones. It's once again this business of a very powerful nation harming a small one, and that really ought to stop.
I want to ask you whether this is true. I heard Ted Koppel say that Haiti, when Haiti overthrew the French, they had to pay reparations, which took almost 250 years to pay off. And Koppel said that a lot of the payment was actually in Haiti's hardwood forests.
I don't know that, but I do know about the payment. It didn't happen immediately. These kidnapped West Africans who threw off their French masters, finally the revolution was over in 1804 and the country was a burned ruin. And, it was an unbelievably bloody revolution. But they claimed their freedom. They created their own republic about 20 years later, in the 1820s in any case. But see, the whole world shunned Haiti. It was the pariah nation. It's not that the Western powers ever stopped interfering in its affairs, but they refused to give it diplomatic recognition. And in part, in return for diplomatic recognition, Haiti had to pay the French reparations for their slave colony. Now, that's a really strange thing if you think about it. I'm a slave, and now I've got to pay you back because I've gone and gotten myself free. When Aristide made the great mistake, and the former president of Haiti made the great mistake not long before the coup that took him again, the second coup in 2003, I made the statement that France should pay reparations itself for those payments. That evoked tremendous indignation from French diplomats, although
a mistake?
I think it was a pretty good case, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, why is that a mistake?
Well, because at that time he was politically weakened and he was under attack from all sides.
He does play a part in this book. You open it with 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what was going on there. Why were you down there? And I should say before we go on that I'm talking with Tracy Kidder about his book Mountains Beyond Mountains. It's about Paul Farmer, the founder of Partners in Health.
Why was I there? I had gone down for the New Yorker magazine to write a story about American soldiers. I thought it was an interesting use of American military power. This is in 1994 when we had sent, I can't remember the numbers now, but something on the order of 20,000 troops to restore the constitutionally elected government of Haiti, which was headed by the enormously popular former parish priest Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide. He had been overthrown shortly after taking office by a military junta. The saying, I think, quite accurate about the Haitian army was that it never had an enemy except the Haitian people. Anyway, they and then for 3 years, this junta ruled Haiti, really. This is one episode where the word terror, it seems to me, was correctly used, terrorized the population. And we finally, under Bill Clinton, we sent troops and restored that government. It was a mixed bag, I think, that occupation. But anyway, I went down and I was hanging out with a bunch of Special Forces soldiers. Having been a soldier myself, I have a real soft spot for soldiers. And I was there one night and Paul Farmer showed up to talk to the commander of this little team of soldiers about a murder case.
And so did you know who he was?
Paul, no. Never heard of him before, but we talked cordially and I listened and took notes while he had this conversation with this young captain. And then I ran into him quite by accident on an airplane going back to Miami at Christmas time that year. And he was very generous with his time and began to interpret Haiti for me. Haiti is very confusing to people like me and to the soldiers I was with. It's, for one thing, language. And for another, the kinds of interpreters that usually soldiers usually get aren't necessarily very reliable. In any case, he was wonderfully generous with his time and information, and I saw him again briefly. But I didn't pursue him, even though I learned that just the outlines of his life and work. And this is 94, but I didn't pursue him for 6 years after that. I think because Haiti had shocked me, and I think I also sensed that if I started following this guy around, he was going to disturb my peace of mind.
Really?
As he did, in fact. Yeah. Well, you know, I think if you, you know, I have a very privileged life, and I think that one loves to imagine that one has earned all one's privileges. And, you know, that kind of notion falls apart immediately when you go to a place like Haiti and you ask yourself a simple question, like, what if I'd been born Haitian? What would my privileges look like then? I don't know. I'm not sure that that's why I didn't pursue him. I went and did something else. But finally, around the turn of the century, right around in late 1999, I met up with him at his hospital in Boston, the Brigham, and he invited me to travel with him for a month.
So Paul Farmer went to Haiti. He went with fresh eyes. Some of that may have had to do very much with the kind of childhood that he led.
Maybe.
What do you feel was the key capacity that he had and the key lesson that he learned in developing this approach? And maybe just briefly tell us, you know, what is really kind of, in a nutshell, the approach of Partners in Health?
I think what they're trying to do is wherever they can, to first and foremost, to relieve suffering and pay attention to individual patients. And I think the technique has been to have individual patients teach them how to treat a family, and a family how to treat a village, and a village how to treat a region, and maybe then how to treat a country. And the two special skills, of course, that Paul and many of his colleagues have brought to this work, but in the early days especially, was both an anthropologist's eye and the clear knowledge that you had to speak, not just speak the language, but understand it, really understand it, so new connotations, and also, you know, skill in medicine. And those two can be a pretty potent combination. Now, just to give you a quick example, it's very easy. I mean, you can read a lot of scholarly papers that say that belief in sorcery, for instance, in some countries is a real impediment to bringing modern medicine to them. But in fact, not if you're an anthropologist. Paul had dozens of voodoo priests who were his patients, and they worked like for a while as virtual community health workers for him. Because if you're an anthropologist, you understand that culture is not a fixed thing, and that if you introduce a cure into a culture, you give some people some pills and on a regular basis, and they start not dying from symptoms that were killing everybody, you know, were always killing everybody before, people are going to look around and say, maybe I'd like those pills. But that doesn't mean they're going to stop believing in sorcery. And in fact, there's a wonderful story in my book to that effect. So, you know, you don't want to go and make enemies of the local, you know, local voodoo priest if that's, you know, in a place like Haiti. You don't have to.
Mm-hmm. And you're really talking about a very profound respect for the people that he's working with.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also an effective one. Yeah, I mean, I think there is a line here. That doesn't mean that you think herbalism is more effective than antibiotics when you know damn well it isn't. But it does mean that, yeah, you want to be respectful, of course. I mean, why else would you be going down there to help these people?
Tracy Kidder talking with me in 2010. You can hear the full interview at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.